From SDPB Radio, I'm Josh Heyer, and you're listening to the In the Moment News Podcast. Each week, In the Moment with Lori Walsh brings you news and arts coverage from across the state. Listen live at 11 a.m. Central, 10 Mountain on SDPB Radio, or tell your smart speaker, play SDPB. You can find every In the Moment segment at listen.sdpb.org or subscribe to the In the Moment Segments Podcast. And now, it's your weekly roundup in news coverage. Senator Mike Rounds joined Lori for a conversation about the role of Congress during a pandemic, the Defense Production Act, and more.
Senator Rounds, thanks for returning to the program.
Well, thanks very much. I appreciate the opportunity just to visit with you and to work our way through some of these rather challenging issues.
They are indeed, and I really appreciate the extended amount of time that we have today as well. So let's settle in and let's talk about, first of all, let's start with the PPE program and casinos, because your office just released a press release about some changes to who in South Dakota qualifies for that PEP payment. The Payment Protection Program protecting those employees and keeping them at work. Let's start there.
Yeah, this is the payroll protection program, and it's designed to allow businesses to continue to keep their employees on their payroll and to continue to pay their benefits, and at the same time to add an additional 25% on top of that for their other expenditures, such as utilities or interest on a mortgage payment or a rental payment. The idea is to keep those businesses up and ready to go as soon as we're ready to open up. Some businesses had said, well, why do I want to keep my employees on if I'm not open? And the idea here is to keep them off of the unemployment roll and to keep them ready to go as soon as that business is ready to open up. It was a way to simplify that process and to expedite getting back into business quicker. And, at the same time, if they wanted to bring them in and just get things ready, if they wanted to make improvements with isolation still in mind, but perhaps improving a business facility and so forth, that would all be part of this. The good news today is that after literally multiple contacts with the Department of Treasury and multiple letters and conversations with our leadership team, we got news today that Treasury has agreed with us and they have changed the guidance on businesses eligible for the payroll protection plan. And they now include gaming facilities with employees of less than 500 employees. So basically, your small casinos, your Native American gaming facilities, the folks out in Deadwood that have less than 500 employees are now eligible to apply for this new round of PPP funding, which is hopefully being signed by the president at this point and will be released very, very shortly by the Treasury. Great news for South Dakota gaming industry.
Yeah. Help us understand, does Treasury make these decisions and then Congress pressures them to make different decisions? When Congress decides the funding and passes the CARES Act, and you can't put limitations or restrictions on, or parameters on that. Tell us how that works, because I don't think I fully understand what Treasury's role is in some of these decisions about how this congressional act is unfolded.
And rest assured, it is one of the more frustrating things that we have to contend with at the federal level. And I'll just give you an example. At the state level, we write a law, and then we basically can look at the rules that are implemented on a department-by-department basis through the Rules Review Committee of the legislature. And if the rules that are being proposed aren't correct, then you can stop it from going into effect in South Dakota. We don't have that at the federal level. And so what happens is you write a law in Congress, such as we did with the CARES Act, and then the individual agencies responsible for the implementation write rules, and then they do what they call guidance on how to interpret their own rules. Well, since about 1984, you have to give credibility and in my opinion, an undue amount of preference to the way the rules are interpreted by the different departments. In this case, the Treasury, working through the Small Business Administration, imposed on all of the CARES Act funds limitations that also applied on previously administered SBA loans. A couple of those included gaming interests were not included in the SBA rules that we felt we had overridden with the direction from the CARES Act. Treasury disagreed, so they arbitrarily included the older rules. One of the other rules that came to light here in South Dakota with a little bit of press, if you have a felony and it's less than 5 years old, you're not eligible for an SBA loan. Well, in this case, they also applied that to the CARES Act. Some people may agree with it or disagree with it, but those series of limitations that were in the earlier SBA rules were just applied by Treasury in their guidance and in their rulemaking to the new CARES Act provisions of the Payroll Protection Plan. We thought it was inappropriate. We challenged them immediately. We sent letters in saying our legislation superseded that, and we specifically included that gaming activities, including Native American gaming, would be included in the CARES Act. In the first two series of guidances that were issued by the Treasury, they ignored us and came out with guidance that first said if more than a third of your income was from gaming, you weren't allowed. And then in the second guidance, they said if more than half of your gaming revenue was from gaming, you weren't allowed. Now they've eliminated that and said, okay, we get it. Gaming interest is now allowed. So we've won it, but nonetheless, we've had to work through a bureaucracy that decided they would interpret it first.
Likewise, and I know we talked about this a little bit last time that we spoke, and Governor Kristi Noem said in her press conference yesterday, and I'm asking you as a senator and as a former governor of South Dakota, she was frustrated with the lack of flexibility to replace revenue from the CARES Act with money that's coming from South Dakota. She said she doesn't want, I'm not asking for new money. She said, I don't want to create new programs. I don't want to grow government with new programs. Help me figure out how to put this money into the revenue that we've already lost as a state that is funded primarily by sales tax. What is the progress on that flexibility? What new programs is this money supposed to create in South Dakota that she is doesn't want to create?
Well, I personally thought we should have allowed more flexibility in the first place, but I'm in the minority. And I was not able to get more flexibility included when we first started looking at this. And when the language was placed in, it was intentionally designed by the authors of the bill. When they agreed to $150 billion going in for the states, it had to be explicitly used for COVID-19 expenses. I pushed that I thought they should have the flexibility to include some percentage of it for a loss of revenue. As an example, in South Dakota, the minimum amount we receive is $1.25 billion. We're not going to have $1.25 billion in COVID-19 expenses at the state and local governmental level. But we will have losses of revenue because we basically directed businesses to shut down. And so South Dakota is relying on sales taxes, relying on video lottery funds, and so forth. And because of that, our revenue will be decreased. Well, if the federal government is recommending and the guidance is to slow things down and to basically isolate, these businesses aren't producing economic activity. We're not receiving tax revenue in the state for economic activity. I felt it only appropriate that at least a percentage of the money which was already being delivered to the state could be used for this revenue replacement. I lost that battle up here. I continue to have opposition on the part of a large number of individuals who fear that the states might very well use it for inappropriate activity. I disagree. I think decisions at the local level are just as scrutinized, if not more closely scrutinized, than what we do in Washington. And we most certainly don't do a great job of scrutinizing the resources that we expend in D.C., and we're not the example that states should follow. So to hold them to a higher level of scrutiny seems to me to be inappropriate. So I support what the governor is suggesting. I have from day one. The governor and I have texted back and forth multiple times trying to figure out a way to get it included. I've also recommended in just the last week or so to my colleagues that we revisit that issue, and that if they're not prepared to put more money into the states, and a number of them don't want to put more money into the states, that we should at least allow for flexibility for the states to be able to utilize some of the funds that have already been allocated. I can also tell you that in our discussions, we've had a little bit of success in that now we are allowing for more flexibility. The Treasury is now laying out more flexibility for these states to be able to use some of the money for other activity, and specifically for unemployment insurance trust funds. And that, you know, as many people are aware, we've got more individuals applying for unemployment. We have higher costs involved in delivering those unemployment funds and so forth. And at least to be able to get those as an additional expense is a step in the right direction, but only a very small step in the right direction.
Governor Noem also spoke this morning at a press conference, and her top things that she was requesting were for South Dakotans to continue to take this seriously, to continue the social distancing measures, and realize that we're in this for the long haul, and mid-June is our new peak. But then the second thing she asked for was increasing in testing capabilities. And this is something that has been in the national news and the local news, this great frustration for manufacturing tests, for manufacturing PPE in America, for manufacturing the swabs that originally came from Italy. Does the United States have a manufacturing problem right now? Because it seems like so much of the economy could get back to work if we could really move in a strongly in the direction of availability of rapid response testing.
Two parts to the answer, I think. First of all, yes, we do have a manufacturing problem here in the United States, in that we have allowed a lot of our capabilities to be moved overseas for economic purposes in some cases, just because other countries can produce it in many cases less expensively because they pay less to their workers than what we do here in the United States. But the second part on that is it leaves us vulnerable to their demands from elsewhere and to market demands on that supply. For purposes of defense, our nation's defense, we have in the past required certain items be manufactured in the United States. There's a group of us that have been discussing legislation that would require a percentage of what we produce for those critical needs to be continued to be produced here in the United States. That means if you identify some of your pharmaceuticals, medical supplies, some of your defense systems, and just as importantly, your food supply, I think we're going to have to go back and have a real serious discussion about giving preference to U.S.-made products. We do that in the National Defense Authorization Act. And in fact, one of the few times in which I actually had a disagreement with the former chairman, Senator John McCain, he and I got at odds because I insisted that we should give a preference to shoes that were made in the United States versus outside of the United States in the NDAA for our armed forces. I think we made the right decision. He wasn't very happy with us at the time, but it allows us to make shoes that are here in the U.S., and it gives our shoe industry a kind of a foot up or a leg up on some of the others, and I think it was the right move. The other side of that is that with regard to the specific items that are in front of us now, the N95 masks, as an example, we could produce those here in the United States, but we have a bureaucracy problem as well, and it's at the federal level. And when it comes to tests, it's not a matter of not being able to get the tests. It's a bureaucracy problem right now at the federal level that's causing a mismatch of where those are being delivered. And I will tell you, we have a problem getting those tests out. And regardless of what we hear about the optimistic reports on testing, we are not doing a good job of getting testing packets out. We may have the testing equipment out to where it's needed. We're still short on the testing packets that go with them. And you need to have both. And And to say that we've got it all set up is not correct. N95 masks, and we're working through a bureaucratic mess right now. We've got a company right here in South Dakota that produces them. They want to produce more. We have been in negotiations. We followed negotiations with 3M, in which 3M has been asked to produce more masks. They're ready to do it, but you got to put in the appropriate manufacturing lines to do that, which means you got to build the line. The companies that built those lines have been waiting for the contract to build the lines now for closing in on a minimum of 3 weeks. And yet, we have pushed with the Department of Defense and with the task force responsible for getting this information out and the contract signed. And even as I speak today, I'm frustrated because we are still waiting for contracts to determine which fund account this should be authorized from. And in the meantime, the companies that build these lines will be looking at other ways to keep their people busy, including moving overseas to build these types of facilities in other countries. There's just no excuse for this kind of delay at the federal level when we've got this kind of a pandemic going on.
What solves the problem? Because that, I think you're expressing the same frustration that so many South Dakotans are expressing. This is America. This is, you know, this is how we won World War II through manufacturing and production. We want to work. We're ready to work. What's the holdup? What opens the door, Senator Rounds? What makes that change?
Due diligence, paying attention to what's going on and not letting our foot off the pedal. At the federal level, the vast majority of the phone calls that I'm having every single day are in conference calls trying to move the ball forward, trying to cut through the bureaucracy that has been put in place. FEMA does a great job when you open them up and you let them get their work done. They cut through the bureaucracy. They have a system which is proven and in place, but you've got to authorize them, and then you've got to let them get their job done. You don't need additional bureaucratic oversight on top of them, and yet that's what we seem to have created within the federal system of government. At the state level, look, we had disasters when I was governor, but we had an emergency operations center, which we would open immediately. We'd run it 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. We'd have it in operation. And in doing so, you allowed the experts to do their job. Today, I'm frustrated because these same folks have to get permission from higher-ups in order to do their job in some cases, because we have task forces that are reinventing the wheel, with all due respect. You know, I think our president truly is doing his best to lay out a plan of attack and to get people moving in the right direction. But when you've got a bureaucracy involved that's always trying to protect their focus, and for some reason they have a difficult time in understanding that sometimes time is of the essence, and you got to move stuff forward and then explain what you're doing as you're doing it rather than waiting for multiple approvals, it makes it more difficult. And I express my frustration because this is exactly the kind of frustration I express when I get into my conference calls, and when, as a member of the United States Senate, we can ask questions, we can push, but we can't make people do things. That falls to the responsibility of the executive branch. We can oversee, and we can make sure that the resources are available, which is what we've tried to do here to a fault. We have now authorized, well, more than, in my opinion, $4 trillion plus. And we want to make darn sure that it gets out as quickly as possible and get this economy back rolling again.
The obvious follow-up question here, Senator Rounds, is that we have heard the president talk about how it's up to the states to sort of bid on their own gear, and governors have been very vocal about their complaints about that. And yesterday we heard the president talk about injecting disinfectant, which of course became a news headline immediately. When we talk about how that task force and how the president of the United States is communicating with the American people, it seems to me that it would be more useful for him to be addressing that bureaucracy and some of the things you're talking about here instead of speculating about unproven science to where Lysol has to come out and say, please do not inject our product. Talk a little bit about communication in those press conferences. What would you like to hear the president say during those times?
Well, first of all, let me reiterate what Lysol has indicated. Please do not inject anything of a cleaning solvent into yourself or into anybody else. Don't try to take it internally. This is not good. I did watch the news conference, and I think what the president is trying to suggest is look, we've got options out there. We're going to get the best of the ideas out there, but we're going to think outside the box. But I think his example in this particular case is not one that anybody should take literally. And I would also suggest very strongly that we're going to use the medical experts, and we will confirm those items which actually work, not items that could be dangerous. And so, I agree wholeheartedly that the Lysol is used as a cleaning disinfectant the way it's supposed to be used and not as an injectant. And I truly don't believe that the president really intended it to come out that way. I just don't believe he did. I think he's saying, look, if there are some things within Lysol, if we can go in and do some more research on that kind of stuff, is there something in it which is, that can be used in the future as a therapeutic? And I think he's musing about all of the different opportunities that are out there. So, I'll add my voice to those who say, do not take that literally. With regard to, the guidance right now, look, I like the idea that we've got a president and a governor who are laying out for us every single day the direction and giving advice, giving counsel in terms of getting things back and operating again, letting everybody know that we're paying attention to it and we want people to get back to work. Absolutely critical. At the same time, we've got to get for people that are worried about their next paycheck, that are worried about whether or not they're going to have enough money to pay for food. We got to let them know that there is immediate help available. That's the reason why we did the first refund checks going back out to as many people as we could get as quickly as possible in terms of $1,200 per person, and $500 per child directly into the checking accounts of as many people as possible so that they have something to get by for a little bit. And second of all, to make sure that people were available through the PPP to maintain their payroll, to convince our businesses. And in South Dakota, we're talking 80% of our businesses have applied for the PPP. That's great news. And that means that the payroll is out there and available for employees of those 80% of the businesses. I like that. I think that was a step in the right direction. But we also have to make sure that as we do this, that we take care of those folks who, through the unemployment rolls, had no other place to go, and that those unemployment checks get out as quickly as possible. We've got a very efficient system here in South Dakota compared to a lot of other states, and we've got people that are dedicated. They've got a huge amount of experience. I think those are, it's a fallback position, but nonetheless, it's a necessary one. But the bottom line is until such time as we can get back to work, we're all going to feel the effects of this pandemic. We just got to do it as safely as possible with good ideas about hygiene, the separation, and so forth. We've got to continue with.
And we have to solve that manufacturing problem. So we have the test kits and the availability to do some of the things that will help us move forward. I have a question, Senator Rounds, about people are looking back about what happened in 2008 and the recession that followed. And one of the things that they are arguing is that that stimulus fatigue kind of caused money to stop coming a little bit too soon, which caused the rebound to be softer than it possibly could have been. And I want to ask you about stimulus fatigue and Congress now going forward. Is there a point where there's less and less offered, and what kind of long term? First of all, do you agree with that assessment about 2008 that more could have been done to help the economy if we'd hung in there a little longer with stimulus? And secondly, how are you looking at that right now as a senator to say we can't get tired of solving this problem before the problem is actually solved? How do we position ourselves best for the best economic recovery when the time comes?
I think the way that I've looked at it is, number one, we have to learn from what we did in the past and whether or not it was successful. With the stimulus at that time, it was designed for shovel-ready products. And there weren't a lot of those shovel-ready products projects out there across the entire country. In South Dakota, we put the vast majority of our stimulus funds, we put it into highway projects and into state and local or local roads repairs and so forth. So we did a lot of that into stuff that really did come back in fairly quickly, but a lot of the states didn't have that available to them. They didn't have the stuff ready to go. So I think number one, any kind of an injection in order to re-stimulate the economy that might come up, I think can't be limited just to shovel-ready stuff. And it needs to be laid out with good planning to allow for an intelligent and thoughtful reinvigoration of infrastructure, water projects, sewer projects, road projects, 5G and 6G activity, all of which, you know, will lend additional economic activity, not just for this generation, for a generation to come. But you still got to, as I told people back in 08 and 09, the complaint that I had at that time was, is how do we pay for it? And as a governor, we accepted the money coming in, but we then asked, so when this does come in, do we have a plan to pay for it? And the same question has to be asked now. We're in the middle of a war, and we know that in the middle of a war, you worry first about winning the war. And then if you have the resources and if you have to borrow the money, which is what we're doing, we're borrowing the money to win the war. And once you are successful in winning the war, and we will be, when we're successful in winning the war, we've got to lay out how we're going to finance this. And, you know, we've added trillions of dollars. We're going to be close to $25 trillion in debt, which is, compared to our GDP, the most we've had since World War II. And we can't take that lightly. So as we look at an infrastructure package, and I know the president would like to do an infrastructure package, because if you look at the resources we've got, the cost of borrowing money today, because of really the worldwide demand for U.S. Treasury dollars and so forth, and in terms of a place where they can safely put their assets, we've got the ability to borrow money at a very, very low rate. And I know that they are, at the present time, refinancing and looking at refinancing a lot of the debt that we've got already with lower interest rates. And I would suspect that the Department of the Treasury will be coming back out and making suggestions about how to lower the payments and extend out the debt over a longer period of time so that we could actually handle it. I would suspect that that may very well be part of the way that we address the issue of debt going into the future, is refinancing some of the debt that we've got and focusing on building the economy so that our GDP is in such a position to where it can actually handle the amount of debt that we are carrying forward.
Where Do We Go From Here is a South Dakota public broadcasting program that usually broadcasts live from the SDPB Black Hills studio in downtown Rapid, bolstered by a studio audience. The show is hosted by Chuck Parkinson and offers thoughtful dialogue about government, leadership, cultural affairs, and who we are as a community now and in the days ahead. It's a gathering. And this is a time when we gather in, well, drastically different ways than we did weeks ago. So until those gatherings resume, we've been welcoming host Chuck Parkinson for an in-the-moment conversation with Lori. This one took place Wednesday. Enjoy.
Let's talk about how and why the government has reacted as it has. What are some of the big, broad things that you're seeing as we move throughout this now here in, you know, at today's April 22nd. So where do you want to begin, Chuck?
Yeah, exactly. The last time we spoke a month ago about this, we were in a whole different situation, I think. And one of the things that's happened is I find it personally quite disturbing that the federal government's response has been, well, you states take care of yourself. The reason the Articles of Confederation failed and the U.S. Constitution was adopted was the fact is the states found that they couldn't in certain times operate on their own. I give big credit to governors throughout the state who have stepped up. The federal government was slow to respond. And from a kind of a personal experience, looking back federal government's always been reactive to things, and all governments are. They don't plan very well, even though agencies within the federal government have planning offices. Planning for the future, stockpiling things, aren't sexy political issues to spend money on. So therefore, we find ourselves, you know, you can't go out really, you know, if you're running for office and say, guess what I did? We bought a bunch of ventilators in there in the, you know, in the stockpile for use when something might bad might happen, as opposed to saying, well, you know, we've got some new money to help build those roads out there in western South Dakota. So you have to look at that particular perspective. I do think that one of the things that as things have slowly moved out, Congress has reacted in a way Congress usually does. But it's more difficult this time because they're operating from afar. I think that that as you look at the way the First CARES Act went into effect, which was actually enacted the last day we spoke, and it's going to be enacted tomorrow, this CARES 2, which is going to have more money that goes into these sorts of things. I think those sorts of things are there. One other thing I think needs to be stressed is that back in the financial crisis in 2008, the Federal Reserve did some things. They learned from that process, and they were able to roll out really quickly because they had been, you know, looking at how do we, if something like this happens again, how do we keep the economy from totally tanking? Now, granted, the economy is not good. Lots of people have lost their jobs, been underemployed, but at least they took those steps in those cases. I think that it's also the case that, you know, federal government moves like it's not a speeding train, you know, not that there are speeding trains. It's like a slow train that moves through Rapid City every day at 5 miles an hour. And getting things going in that direction is sometimes is very frustrating. And when we're in a 24/7 news reporting cycle, people get, you know, it's anxious from that standpoint. And as you look at the way things are reported every day, you know, the fear and angst continues to grow. When actually good people are trying to do good things.
Are we hearing from the federal government that there is a federal response to increase testing, or are we just hearing calls to get the economy and the economic engine churning again?
Lori, from my view, I think we're not hearing what we should be hearing as far as as the promotion of testing goes. I was happy to see that in the package that the Congress has just approved that there is $25 million, $1 billion available for widening the testing operation and $75 billion available to help hospitals out for frontline PPE and other types of activities. I have seen some things which are in there. You know, I know that there are research institutions throughout the country that are working 24 hours a day, universities, medical research areas, trying to come up with different things that might work. And hopefully, you know, all of these efforts are going to lead to something that's going to give us a situation. I saw a piece from a professor at Rutgers University yesterday that's working with Mount Sinai Hospital in New York City and a couple of other places where, and they're also working with the DNA companies that you see out there, 23andMe and, you know, and the others, to look at maybe swab, not using swab testing, but to use saliva testing. And the preliminaries give quick results right on scene. And you know, I don't know if you've taken a DNA test, but, you know, you basically spit into a jar. And to be able to get a quick return around, because it, you know, the doctor who they were speaking to said, look, the germs are held in your saliva a lot more than they are if they dissipated if you sneezed, and we could get a better touch on that. Is that a good one? Yeah, exactly. Will other things help? Exactly. But it is, it's going to take some time, as it always does, because one of the things that leads to vaccine that works, you have random tests of all kinds, and then you build up to see where things are going to go. There's no miracle cure that's just going to drop out of the sky tomorrow.
If there was something like those antibody cassette testing, then the question goes back to the same thing. Who's, you know, is every governor going to be bidding wildly on those? Or is there some kind of a federal coordination of whatever happens next here? Because we still have the same problem as far as what is the federal response versus
and I
the
think
state
it's
response.
Truly unfortunate that the president has told the governors, you're kind of on your own here. This is really something where the federal government needs to step up and do things. I know that it's classic stroke to say, you know, we don't need the federal government to do things. We don't need government. They're too much in the way. And in this part of the world, that's as strong. And it was touched on in your earlier segment today where the individualism, we can pull ourselves up by our bootstraps. Well, you know, we can't. And this is the time that we need to have that national effort to be able to step up and say things and to pit different regions or states against each other when the national federal government should be stepping up and taking a lead in that so we have a coordinated response rather than have this makeshift response out there. And, you know, state governments, and South Dakota is not going to be spared from this. We don't have a great budget surplus. And if we're forced with having to go out in the time, you know, because we appear to be, you know, our peak is going to be far later than other places, and all of a sudden we have got to start bidding against, you know, California, who has a little more income-related effort than we do, what are going to be the effort here, and where is South Dakota going to get that money to pay for these things? We don't have that. You know, the only place we can do it is change the budget and take money away from education, which makes up 50% of our budget from that standpoint, and other things. And quite frankly, to put states in that particular position, I find to be horrifying. And it's one of those things that it's inevitably going to happen. We're seeing it happen to other states, and this is going to have a long-term economic impact upon us also.
Tell me why we've seen problems arise in the delivery of the stimulus funding, you know, some people getting their checks and some not, and then the stimulus and stabilization funding to individual businesses. Why was that so problematic to execute?
Let me tell you something. The IRS is responsible for sending out. The two main places are the IRS and the Small Business Administration, and then, of course, your state unemployment officers. All of those offices have been technologically strapped forever. Since 2010, the IRS budget has been dropped by 20%. They have 20% fewer employees. And you may not be aware of this, but the base mainframe system for the IRS technology was put in place when John Kennedy was president. It's 60 years old. There have been upgrades made. I want to tell you a funny personal story about how this is for spending money for it. When I was the staff director of the Treasury Postal Service and General Government Appropriations Subcommittee in the middle 1980s, the IRS and the Treasury Department said we need to do upgrades for technology because the return on the technology we're going to get is going to be incredible. And, you know, like $30 to the dollar spent. So Congress, in its wisdom at that particular point, added in about $200 million to upgrade the technology system at the IRS. And because, you know, you can understand what kind of a political uproar that made, because more money for the IRS. Well, President Reagan vetoed that bill. And amazingly, 2 weeks later, a supplemental appropriations request silently was delivered to the appropriations committees for $200 million for technologies, which we later enacted. But once again, it was one of those things that it was political, you know, gamesmanship at that point. And we go forward from those sorts of things, which that's one of those funny anecdotal things you see. But, you know, the failure for state governments, federal governments, to put money into technologies has put us in the boat where we are. I think one of the things you'll also find is the fact that state governments with state unemployment offices, from what I read the other day, South Dakota's actually done pretty well in the first couple of weeks in getting things out. But antiquated systems and spending money on technology are not sexy. And then you also have a case where you look at the PPP program and how they were distributed. I find it appalling that 20 companies that have a net operating worth of over $100 million got huge amounts of money, and I'm not sure those little mom-and-pop stores out there on the street are getting that kind of funding. And one of the reasons are those big companies have got lawyers and accountants that know how the system works, and not to point fingers at banks, but I will. Banks get bigger fees when they make bigger loans. And making these kinds of loans go to those sorts of systems, one of the things that's in the new bill that just passed is that there is money set aside for community banks and small regional banks, which I think is incredibly important to get money to the small mom-and-pop businesses that we have in towns and all throughout the country, but especially here in South Dakota. I would like to throw one other thing out, just to, way the system works. I read this morning that part of the thing is providing funding, and the First CARES Act is providing funding to universities to help students out. And there were four schools that I noted that got money that are fairly well, have fairly big endowments: Harvard, Stanford, Yale, Princeton. Now, granted, they have low income students that they go there on scholarships, but their endowments are huge. I would dare say that they're much larger than what we are, and I'm not sure that schools in South Dakota have received, because quite frankly, they don't have that kind of input from that standpoint. But maybe the face of embarrassment would lead some of these to say, hey, maybe we don't need these money, and we need to get back and look at it and look at it from a standpoint. And I think this is where the oversight and accountability of Congress is going to come into play. Right now, because Congress is operating from afar, that sort of oversight really isn't taking place. But it's hard work, and it's going to be necessary to have lessons learned here so we can apply them the next time that it happens. The one saving grace is, this is a little in the weeds, but the General Accountability Office, which is headed by the Comptroller General, has 3,000 really dedicated employees, and they are good. Let me tell you, I worked with them for many years when I worked on Capitol Hill, and they're professionals, and they can give a quick down and dirty look at things, and they've already launched a number of oversight things and to try to assist at the federal level, which is good because we need that effort.
How does the national media report on South Dakota, especially during the current pandemic? How do we balance civil liberties and personal responsibility as protests increase in cities under lockdown? And what does the future hold for our weekly newspapers? This Wednesday, we invited the Dakota Political Junkies to speak on these topics.
Michael Cart is an associate professor of political science at the University of South Dakota in Vermilion. Welcome back, Mike. Thanks for being here.
Good afternoon, Laurie.
And John Hunter is publisher of the Madison Daily Leader. Good to have you back, John.
Thanks, Laurie. I enjoy being here.
Let's get started with the national gaze, which has landed on South Dakota in a way that I don't remember from before. Certainly the Smithfield plant for a while was the largest outbreak or cluster of COVID-19 cases in the nation, and that brought a lot of eyes and coverage, which is not over. We've not seen the end of it, for sure. So let's talk about some of the things that you've noticed about how national organizations really talk about South Dakota and who in South Dakota talks to them. John Hunter, you want to get us kicked off with that?
Oh, I think it's very interesting. I mean, and I remember right away when the New York Times wrote about the Smithfield plant, my cousin in New York sent that link to me, and it was clearly written through the lens of what New Yorkers think about these sorts of things. Remember, they're kind of a ground zero in some senses of high infection rates and so forth. So they clearly thought we were Hicks from somewhere else because we weren't doing what New Yorkers doing. It's kind of like the old poster with the life beyond the Hudson River. And then the BBC, of course, picked it up. We're not used to usually having stuff from Sioux Falls covered on British television, but I do think they'd really look at it through their own lens, the way things are happening in their and then not translating it, the fact that other areas might be different. But because it was such a hot spot, and again, the top one for a little while, I think it probably deserved news coverage. And I was glad it was picked up by national media.
Right. It's often that our stories aren't covered at all, John. So nothing happens here. It seems to be relevant. And then one day, all of a sudden, we have a problem of this magnitude, and it's relevant.
Here's
you know, Governor
one,
Kristi Noem said, you know, we're not New York. So in some ways, it goes both ways in the sense that, you know, my daughter was in college in New York, and the number of things people said about the cesspool of New York City, we were thinking, well, that's not really true. So it's pretty tempting to define an other when it comes to this story, isn't it?
You might have found something.
Yes, the old. Go ahead, John.
I'm sorry. Go ahead.
It's the old saw that where you stand depends upon where you sit.
Right.
There was an article this morning, Lori, in the San Francisco Chronicle that said some wealthy Silicon Valley people are heading out to South Dakota for a luxury bunker community. And we spent a little time trying to figure out where a luxury bunker community was in South Dakota.
Isn't it Igloo?
That's what I was thinking.
Right. There was a story. I think we'll have to ask Seth Tupper, but didn't he do a story when he was with the Rapid City Journal about, you know, sort of doomsday bunkers, which exist in New Zealand and in South Dakota near the Igloo area? And some people have already purchased things and are sort of working on what they would look like in the event of an emergency. And who knew? Some of those wealthy people are now cashing in and saying, I'm ready to move in. Do you have the power set up?
I didn't know that it was ready to go, but apparently people are taking advantage of it.
I'm going to have to look up that story and find out if I'm accurate, but I have a memory that's tickling the back of my brain. Mike Card, talk a little bit about how our officials are appearing. You know, how many times has Governor Noem been on Fox News, and Mayor Paul Ten Hankin from Sioux Falls is talking to Chris Cuomo, and Chris Cuomo is saying, I'm going to give you my cell phone number, and if there's anything you need, you give me a call. And so it puts a lot of pressure on an opportunity on local leaders as well. People who work at the Smithfield plant are talking to national news organizations. We saw a friend of my daughter's from high school on television the other day talking about her parents as the children of Smithfield. They didn't mention her name, but of course we recognized her. So this is a definitely an opportunity for people to be heard and an opportunity for some kind of national attention as well to sort of explain what's happening here more clearly and to really explore the problem at a national level. I don't know what the question there is for you, Mike, but...
I spend a lot of time talking when I do get a call from someone from the national media, trying to tell them a little bit about South Dakota, you know, that we have 2,200 people per square mile in Sioux Falls. And as we get up to Harding County, we have one person for every two square miles. And in between those two areas, we have some areas of concentrated people and some not. And I think most people just can't even fathom that in the larger communities. And our political culture is more agrarian and small town based. Even in Sioux Falls, you see people who have moved from smaller communities to Sioux Falls expect the same access to the mayor, whether it's Mayor Ten Hankin or others, that they had in Selby, for example. And so that's just the nature of what our state is.
Right.
And it just doesn't match their reality.
It doesn't match their reality. And now we have the racetrack that's going to have races in Southeast South Dakota. And John, talk a little bit about Governor Kristi Noem has been very clear about what her directions are and what her actions will be. And sometimes you see that reported accurately in the national news, and sometimes you just hear a broad brush where they just say South Dakota didn't shut down, which is not exactly true to say that South Dakota didn't shut down, because sometimes they make it sound like we're all just going about our business casually. But tell us a little bit about, I can't remember what my question was there, John, help me out. I was going, it's been a long week already, and it's only Wednesday.
Well, no, you're that's a very good observation that other, I think, media outside talks about South Dakota's governor in comparison to other states. And I think we've talked on this program earlier that we didn't think it was going to be a one-size-fits-all, that each community, each state, each maybe micro-community would have to do things differently. But we seem to get grouped in with governors who appear to the national media as you're not quite with it yet because you're in the among the eight states that have not shut down. And again, they're kind of painting that as just as you describe, we're just a kind of business as usual, which it isn't. So I've had to explain that to some people far away who have called and asked about that. And in fact, one of them said, "Have you had any cases of COVID-19 yet in South Dakota?" Well, yes, we have, and we've had them since, we had them 6 weeks ago or whenever that started. And yes, people are asked to stay home, and yes, all events have been called off larger than certain numbers. And so I've had to kind of explain that. So I'm not sure the communication is clear yet about what we are doing, and maybe people are just looking at headlines and not the full story.
Right. Or maybe the messaging itself is unclear, and that needs to be addressed as well. And this kind of brings us to our next topic, which is this idea of a partisan gap kind of emerging as people look at the headlines that they want to look at or think independently about some of the things that are happening in their neighborhoods and across the country. And Mike Carty, I want to start with you because you had some research that I thought was really very interesting that you shared with us before the program about how people feel about social distancing and I'm using in quotations, the opening of an economy, but basically places that are closed, reopening, and how they would do that. And boy, you can see that we don't agree on that and that a lot of the reason we don't agree is politics.
Well, it is, and we have a definite difference based on political parties on a wide variety of things, and we often forget to talk about what we have in common. But certainly we see that nationwide polling, there are just 11% of the voters who think that their governor is doing too much, and there are 49% who say that the Trump administration isn't doing enough in response to the outbreak, although that number is decreasing, that there is more favorability. But if we look at the age even, those who are over 65 are much more worried about our response to the virus than those younger. I don't think that's a surprise to any, especially for those of us over 60. We're a little bit more concerned. But the one that's more striking is the difference between Republicans and Democrats in terms of whether the approach is appropriate. And some of that is being fed by the New York news media as well. Certainly there is one particular network that has jumped on the bandwagon, so to speak, of the we need to reopen the economy and we need to reopen it now. I don't think there's any doubt that there is damage to our economy, certainly. You look around, and I think every one of us knows somebody intimately who's either been furloughed or laid off or has their hours cut, and yet the average person across the nation expects we're going to be socially distancing for a couple more months.
And I think it's important to note that 65% in that study of Republicans say that the priority should be addressing the spread of the virus. It's 88% among Democrats and 72% among independents. So there is a partisan divide, but still the majority of Republicans are saying, the economy is important and worth addressing, but the pressing priority right now is to address this spread of the virus. So we agree on a lot of things, but there's also an increasing look that we're disagreeing. Mike, do you think that's because of what we're watching and what we listen to? I mean, I don't want to lay everything on the feet of different, what newspaper you read or which channel you turn to, but why would there be such a huge difference between, is it just, that's just politics and that's how it works? Or are we getting different messages?
I think we're partly receiving different messages that are usually reinforcing previously held beliefs. The other side is there are ideological differences between the political parties, and a more collectivist approach is more commonly held by people who are registered with the Democratic Party, and a more individualistic approach are, we're on our own. We can pull ourselves up by our own bootstraps, or represented by people who are registered as Republicans in terms of their political party preference. And so we see and hear people saying, well, I'll take my chances. I'd rather work than not work, even if it puts my health at risk.
John Hunter, any thoughts that you want to add about a partisan divide? And really, it seems like it's only going to increase in the days ahead, because let's not forget, we are heading toward a presidential election.
I think Mike is right on. There is some divide, and then there's also some kind of reinforcement that you read or listen to what you already believe, and it gets amplified a little bit. We actually went through a number of weeks of this pandemic without that, and yeah. I think at least some of us thought that was kind of refreshing, that there was
a
moment of coming together and so forth. And so the case that I think of in Georgia, where the governor, I think, is eagerly opening things up kind of in opposition to what the mayors are thinking in these things, where they're kind of aggressively opening things, even, kind of personal touch sorts of industries like hair styling and tattooing and those sorts of things that just seem a little bit out of touch with at least what the mayors are thinking. So that one does appear to be a little bit more partisan to me. But I think the fact that we'll have an election this year, I think, could very well bring that up, even though you haven't seen a lot. I mean, it's still kind of almost nomination time. You know, the conventions are scheduled for the summer, virtual or otherwise, and then the real battle begins, I think, later in the summer.
John, do you think that the response to the coronavirus is going to overtake anything else as a political football more than anything else? Finger-pointing. Is that the key issue, to look at how this administration handled the outbreak and how Joe Biden, if he is the presumed nominee, is going to say he would have done it differently, or he will do it differently going forward?
I've thought a lot about it, and it does seem as though that elections tend to focus a little bit on recent events, not the whole 4 years or even the next 4 years. And of course, the economy always does seem to play an outsized part to that. If there happens to be a recession in an election year, the incumbent gets tossed. If the economy is strong, they tend to get reelected. So I think it's possible that if the economy is in some sort of free fall, then it would become a much bigger issue. But if things, kind of modestly return to some sort of growth between, midsummer and November, then I think other issues might get in there as well.
Yeah.
Presidential voting tends to be very personal. How do I feel about the economy, and how do I feel relative to where I was before the incumbent took office? And, I think a lot of this is going to depend upon how quickly we can control the spread of the virus, how quickly we can get testing so that then we can start testing people, identifying those who are infected and isolate them, quarantining those who have been exposed. Without that, we're waiting for a vaccine, which the virologists tell us is 18 to 24 months away. So it would seem to me that without an uptick in the economy, I think John's exactly right, that we're likely to have a new president in January 20th of 2021. If things turn around more quickly, we'll probably see a reelection.
Mm-hmm. A lot's going to happen between now and November. I want to close real quickly with these weekly newspapers, local news. We talked about national news to begin the program. All that fades away, and what's left is your hometown newspaper. John Hunter, how has it been? It's been such a challenge for so many people running newspapers. You've been in this business longer than I think anyone in South Dakota. And
Way up there.
Tell me a little bit about what this ride has been like.
Well, I do think about weekly newspapers a lot. I have certainly friends who are publishers, and they are customers of ours, too, because our plant prints many, many weekly newspapers. And I think, like any small, medium, or large newspaper, they are affected by the local economy. And so if stores are closed and advertising is cut back, it's very hard on newspapers as well as other businesses. So I think they're challenged by it, and they're trying to do everything they can to last through this. And then when advertising and their local businesses pick up, they'll be there to continue the good journalistic work. I know you had on as guests not too long ago Dale Blagan, publisher at Lake Preston and DeSmet. And I have good news to report, and those two papers have now been sold and will be restarting the first week in May. So we're glad for that. So far, all the newspapers in South Dakota have survived so far, and I think they're eager to do great work in their communities. And I think in the case of Lake Preston and DeSmet, I think the community realized after Dale announced that he was going to be closing, that they really rallied and said, "Hey, this is a community asset that we want, and we're going to do what it takes to make it happen."
For most of us, if we are infected with the novel coronavirus, we will be able to take care of ourselves at home without a trip to the hospital. But that means we have to figure out how to provide supportive care at home, including ways to prevent the spread of the highly contagious virus to the people we live with. For help with that, we welcomed Rhonda Wearing, Director of Clinical Growth and Innovation with Avera at Home.
Rhonda, welcome. Thank you for being here.
Hi, good afternoon.
I want to start, thank you for joining us, and I want to start with what to do before you get sick, because if you're like me, you're getting a lot of email messages and social media background noise about things that you can do to boost your immune system, and I'm wondering if they're all kind of junk, or does how much you sleep and how hard you work and what your stress level is and what you're eating right now really make a difference to boosting your immune system if you get the virus?
Definitely. So I thought it was important that you pointed out that most people who do get the virus are going to be able to care for themselves at home. And there's a lot of things that folks can do to stay healthy at home, so that if you do get the virus, by doing some of these things, you'll be more apt and to stay on the mild end of the illness and be able to manage at home. So things like, for your immune system, making sure that you're getting enough sleep is very super important. Recommending to limit your smoking, eat a diet that's high in fruits and vegetables. Exercise is super important. Now that it's getting to be springtime, hopefully you can get outside and get some fresh air while social distancing. Alcohol in moderation is super important. And then taking steps to avoid infection is really, honestly, the most important thing. So really being meticulous with hand hygiene and washing your fingertips and between your fingers very frequently, washing all the surfaces of your home in order to keep them infection-free, things like your doorknobs and your handles and your sink faucets, and those kinds of things are super important as well.
Help us understand how the immune system works. If you've been a lifelong smoker, or if you've had maybe a poor diet in the past, it can feel like, well, it's too late now, or how soon can it make a difference? Or people have questions about exactly how the immune response really, how our immune response can react to lifestyle changes. How long does it take?
You know, that's a good question. And well, I don't profess to be an expert in that exactly. I'm not an immunologist or anything like that. But starting today, why not? You know, it can only help you and only help you be prepared for being able to be stronger physically in order to prevent that spread of infection if you do get it.
Yeah. And I've noticed if I'm eating poorly or I'm eating well in the past few days, because I'm so hyper in tune with how I feel, as we all sort of obsessively self-monitor, there have been a few times where I'm like, I'm really tired. And then I look at what I ate and I realize that maybe it has to do with nutrition in the past day, if I had a day where I was just a little off on what I was eating. So we notice if we're listening to our bodies, you know, how we feel, right? Tune in.
Yeah, for sure. And I think, like, if you are tuned in, that you will start to notice by eating some different foods that maybe your body responds in a different way. Pay attention when you have a diet that's really full of sugar. Pay attention to how you feel as opposed to reducing some of that sugar in your diet. There are some things that, you know, foods that are more rich in producing immunity, and those would be things like citrus fruits, red bell peppers, which are both rich in vitamin C. Spices are good too. Ginger, garlic, turmeric. There's a lot of literature about the importance of zinc, and they can get zinc very naturally in some things like beef and egg yolks, things that most of us eat on a regular basis. What else? I was just trying to think if there might be some other things. You sometimes read about magnesium foods. Rich foods will, in addition to helping you feel calmer, they can support your immunity. So things that are high in magnesium that we often have around, most people do, are nuts and seeds and leafy greens, those kinds of things. Whole grains have a lot of magnesium in. And of course, things like fatty fish, you see so much about that in the news, being really good with those omega-3 acids, salmon and those kinds of things. So always eat probiotic-rich foods that will help you fight infections, things like sauerkraut or I like kefir. Those can be bought in the health part of the grocery store.
Yeah, now is a good time to pay attention for, you might even change some life skills here in the future. Let's talk about if you do feel like you're coming down with COVID-19 and you're feeling kind of terrible, maybe you have a fever, you start having a cough. What do we know about supportive care? First, for people who are confused by that term, define supportive care.
Well, supportive care, I think, especially if you get sick, starts with like understanding your symptoms and how they compare to your baseline. If you are, first of all, in the early stages of a possible COVID infection, or maybe it's a simple head cold, pay attention to how does this compare to your baseline. And do the things like home isolation, stay home from work, that's super important, disinfecting your high-touch surfaces, changing your clothing every day and your bed linens to just, which will be a recommended practice just to keep, you know, your environment healthy for healing. Pay attention. One of the indicators you should take a look at is your fever. If you don't have a thermometer, we would recommend you try to get one. Hopefully you are able to. They're a little bit in high demand these days. Because I'm not a physician, I won't prescribe what fever medicine you should take, but Tylenol is a pretty generally accepted fever medication for COVID, taken in the recommended daily dose, or you can always check with your physician as well.
Now, for a lot of times, we've said for a fever to kind of let it go if you can, because that fever is fighting the infection. When do you sort of start Tylenol or something like that to fight the fever? Do you just go for it and get it on board right away, or do you try to let the fever run its course a little bit?
There's a lot of debate about that. But generally, you know what, when a body has a fever, that's a sign that they're trying to fight an infection, and it's not a bad thing. So if your fever is low grade, that's anything, you know, in that 100, 100-ish kind of range, you may not need anything for your fever as far as medications, unless you're having a lot of achiness, and you might take Tylenol for that achiness. However, if you get your fever climbs and is not responding to fever medication, and it's in that 104 range, that's certainly a time to, that's a situation where you need to reach out to your medical provider and get direction as to what you should do next. So pay attention again with regards to supportive care, how it feels. Pay attention how you feel. If your symptoms are upper respiratory, or if you're having shortness of breath, that will also be something that you'll need to pay attention for and potentially seek medical treatment for.
What does how much shortness of breath and how bad should the cough be? People have a hard time understanding. Like, when do we know it's an emergency, and we really need to get in the car, contact the emergency room, and tell them that we're coming?
So definitely pay attention to what your baseline is. But certainly things like if you are having trouble talking through a sentence without feeling short of breath, that's a sign that you and you're working harder to breathe. Certainly if your fingers or lips take on a bluish tint, that would become a medical emergency at that time. But hopefully if you start paying attention to this shortness of breath that you're starting to have, do things like, as you're trying to prevent your illness from progressing, there's a lot of things that you can do to kind of put yourself in an optimal position for getting well. Those include like staying very well hydrated, unless you have a medical contraindication for drinking a lot of water. Drink a lot of water, because that water is going to help you. Also, many times with COVID, you have a lot of fatigue, and you might feel like staying in bed mostly. We encourage you to get up and walk around your room, take 10 deep breaths every hour, keep your lungs as full as you can. If you use a fan also can help your shortness of breath. You can, if you're living with a family and have these symptoms, keep your bedroom door closed while you're using that fan to prevent the spread of infection. Open your window can also help. Those tips can help somebody from getting to the serious medical crisis of needing to go to the emergency room or calling the ambulance. So do those things first. But then if you get to the point where you cannot finish a sentence without taking a breath, or you're using your intercostal muscles, working really hard to breathe, make sure that you're getting medical attention.
Right. And I think that's important to say, because so many people I talk to are so afraid of going to the hospital that they have this sense that the hospital is a place where they're going to be left in a hallway or something. And that really isn't the case in South Dakota right now, that we've not, you know, the hospitals are prepared to meet the surge. So it's not something you need to put your health at risk to stay home. And talk to me a little bit, Rhonda, about humidifiers and humidity, because we've seen some, you know, stories that say humidity might be a really good thing. If you have a humidifier, do you keep it running now?
What you read in literature about humidifiers is they're a breeding ground for bacteria, which isn't a good thing. So humidifiers are fine as long as they're really well cleaned every day with probably some bleach solution. And then that will help those humidifiers, you know, not be infection spreaders. So they can help. The biggest thing is to stay hydrated. That's kind of the preface of a humidifier, is to keep that room environment moist. But again, if you do use a humidifier, make sure you're cleaning it very well, disinfecting it every single day.
That's a good lesson for me. I don't clean mine nearly enough. I love my humidifier, but yeah, good tip. I'll have to check that one out. How about oxygen meters or peak flow meters? Some people who have asthma have these tools at home. How can they be used to sort of help monitor, in particular, people who already have an underlying condition like asthma?
So are you talking about oximeters?
Yes, thank you.
Okay, oximeters is a small device that measures your PO2, And if you have one of these devices, that's a good thing. You can use this if you're short of breath and have COVID. Not everybody needs an oximeter. Remember that, you know, most of our population is going to go get through COVID with very mild symptoms. And there are ways to monitor your shortness of breath and your breathing without an oximeter. So I'll be the first to promote the use that you don't need oximeters in every case. Definitely not, because you can tell how's your breathing. You can tell if it's easy to breathe, if you're feeling short of breath, if you are becoming more short of breath. All of those things you can physically just assess when you're doing your daily assessment of, like, how am I feeling today? Am I feeling better? How's my breathing? What's my fever like? Did I drink all my water? So, but oxygen meters are a very useful tool for folks who are more sick at home. And we have a program that we've developed that will use oxygen meters for patients who are at home and really are in the category of more sick. And I can tell you about that if you'd like to know about that today.
Yes, please.
So while most patients, 80% of people who get COVID will be less sick and can get, you know, do these, all of these preventative and good health things that I talked about, there will be some of the population that gets what I'll call, for simplicity reasons today, more sick. And those folks should make sure that they're in touch with their physician. And their physician, if they've identified them as more sick and needing some additional nursing assistance, could enter into a program we've got. It's called a virtual home COVID program, whereby we provide oximeters for people to check their oximetry level, and a nurse calls the patient every day on the phone and helps them monitor their symptoms. And the goal of that program is to help that patient recover, get over their more sick situation. Also, we can help the patient if they need to go to the hospital, potentially. We would be able to help the patient facilitate that. Again, not many patients will need our program, but we're here as a help for those patients that get more sick and need some additional assistance at home, and hopefully we can help them get well and then not have to go to the hospital.
Since the first case of COVID-19 in Washington State, our next guest spent a lot of time there working on the new episode of PBS's Frontline, which premiered on Tuesday. Miles O'Brien is the writer, producer, director, and correspondent for Coronavirus Pandemic. You can find it on the PBS video app and online at pbs.org/frontline.
I want to get in our remaining minutes about to what's next, because it ties into this production. If we know that massive testing is the way to get the economy going and massive contact tracing and we need testing supplies, we need personal protective equipment for the people doing the testing, we have the Defense Production Act in the president's pocket. What the heck? Why can't, you know, we've had a few months now. It's very frustrating to get through this documentary and to read the news and to listen to people talk and say, why haven't we solved that problem yet? We're America. We have manufacturers all across this country, and you're telling me we can't figure out how to get enough test kits and gowns and masks to the people doing the testing to make a dent in this problem? Help us understand what the holdup is there.
Well, Lori, I consider it a compliment that my film made you frustrated, right? Because I have been, I actually do, because I have been beating my head against the wall trying to figure out why this is happening in our great and glorious country. This is the, you know, in the World War II, we called it the arsenal of democracy. I grew up in the Detroit area. You know, there's these famous stories of Henry Ford turning automobile assembly lines into B-24 bomber assembly lines almost overnight, and rolling one off the assembly line in less than an hour, each one in less than an hour. I mean, extraordinary. The reason we won World War II is because of logistics and supplies. That's really the secret sauce, right? And to say that's not important is just not understanding how you fight wars. And this is a war. And it is frustrating to imagine that a president who has said not too long ago he has complete and total authority seems reluctant to use one of the things where he does have complete and total authority, which is to use the Defense Production Act to force industry, order industry to make things. He can do that. And for reasons I don't have the insight on that sitting here in Seattle, but so far he's been the allegation among governors and others is that he's been very slow to employ this technique. I don't have any understanding why that is, but we can solve this pretty easily in this country. We're good at this stuff, but it does require a cohesive federal strategy and leadership.
Governor Inslee says the most dangerous element in the virus is complacency, and now we're looking at a time where people are getting anxious. They want they can't pay their rent. They're getting hungry. They need to go back to work. They're tired of staying inside voluntarily. We're having issues in South Dakota about what kind of events we can have. So much is happening. We don't have this massive testing. We don't have protective equipment, not only for a surge in our hospitals, but to test the number of people that we need. What is the risk of just going back to normal that Governor Inslee is sort of warning about? And how is Washington kind of going forward? We really just have a minute to wrap it up here, Miles.
Well, I'll just say it quickly. What you had happen there at the pork processing facility is exactly the risk. Until we know who's sick, who isn't sick, who's been sick, who's immune, you can't think about reopening and having people working in close proximity in a food production plant. So we need to get testing and testing many orders of magnitude bigger than we're doing it right now. The states cannot do this on their own. The federal government has to step in and help get these supply chains going so we can test in a way that allows us to imagine returning to our lives. It can be done. We can't be defeatist about this, but we also can't be impatient either. Going outside, eliminating the precautions that we've taken right now prematurely, we're going to be right back in the weeds in June or July.
Now that's the show for this week. Thank you for joining us. Again, if you're looking for an individual segment from our radio program, you can find all of our segments at listen.sdpb.org or by following the In the Moment Segments podcast. And if you have a story idea, send an email to inthemoment@sdpb.org. For Lori Walsh and Chris Loffrey, I'm Josh Heyer. Thank you for listening.